If you want to understand people of the past, one of the best things that you can find are the people themselves.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Melody Edwards, filling in for Micah. This is part one of a mammoth two-part archaeological and fossil series. We'll start with a team of University of Wyoming archaeologists who are on the case to find a missing mammoth. How do you lose a 6-ton extinct animal that lived 13,000 years ago? Well, you find a few of its bones, but lose track over the decades of exactly where they were found. I sat down with the University of Wyoming anthropology professor Todd Surivel, the detective trying to put all the clues together. His story starts on a drizzly day when fieldwork on a dig near Douglas just wasn't going to happen.
We arrived, it was raining and it wasn't a good time to set up camp, so we decided to take the students to the Pioneer Museum in town. It was my first visit to that museum, and in the museum, in one of the cases, they had some mammoth bones, a couple of front limb bones, the jaw or the mandible, and a couple of other teeth. And I was really intrigued. I mean, one, I love mammoths, I'm fascinated by them. And two, the first people in the New World, the people who I study, people who lived here at the end of the last ice age, hunted mammoths. So any mammoth that's found is not only an interest to paleontologists, but it's potentially of interest to archaeologists. In the display case, there was some signage that was interesting. It said the bones were donated by William Eastman. It said that the bones are found on Bedtick Creek. And it said that they were discovered by Dr. Bird from the American Museum of Natural History.
But then the Pioneer Museum found a letter in their archives from this other guy, an L.C. Bishop, claiming that he had found the bones 20 years earlier, back in 1938.
The signage in the display case didn't make sense. At least we didn't know what the Dr. Bird reference was. We knew there's a famous archaeologist who had worked at the American Museum at the time, named Junius Bird. So we reached out to them to ask if Junius Bird had ever been in Wyoming and excavated a mammoth. And actually they got back to us and gave us some documentation from 1938. And it was actually Junius Bird's brother, R.T. Bird, who came through the area and apparently looked at the site and decided that the rest of the mammoth had eroded away. That's not what Bishop said in his letter in 1958. He said that after they pulled out those bones, they caved over the bank to preserve it so it could be excavated later by professionals. And he said at the time there were several feet of vertebrae sticking out of the bank. So from what we can tell, the site sat from the 30s until the 50s. But the only other information we have about anybody going to the site was that the new director of the Pioneer Museum found a small brown paper bag with three bone fragments in it, and typed on that bag is a message saying that Bishop went out there with two companions named Vetter and Hildebrand in July of 1958 and removed a few bones. I assume they're going out to check on it to see if it was still there. Those bones were in the bag. And as far as we know, that's the last time anybody's actually went out to the site. Now, one question we have is the mammoth still there, right? It's certainly possible that they excavated the entire mammoth at the time, but if they did, where would it be? All we have are these three small bone fragments left in that bag. Another possibility is that erosion has since removed the animal.
Did in any of the places that where you were getting some of these letters and things, did anybody ever give any directions for where the place is approximately?
Yeah, actually, we have a number of clues which are really interesting.
Clue number one, the sign in the museum that says it's near Bedtick Creek, a tributary of the North Platte near Douglas. But clue number two, in Bishop's letter, he also says he owned the land where he found the bones, and that it was in a cut bank near a distinctive rocky ridge.
It helps us to narrow down our options from somewhere in Wyoming to a very specific area. Except it's not that simple, of course, because the first thing we noticed was that the section that Bishop noted in his letter, he never actually owned. So there's a direct contradiction there. We wonder if Bishop made an error in describing the location of it and describing the section, but that would be unusual because he was the county surveyor. He knew his way around. So this summer, with the blessings of the landowners who have been absolutely wonderful in this process, we went out and we started poking around in this draw, mostly doing something called augering, which means drilling holes down through the sediments to look at the stratigraphy, to try to figure out where we have sediments of the right age. Now, we know the age of the mammoth because we radiocarbon dated it. So when we went out this summer, we were trying to identify areas along that draw that have sediments of that age. And there are several stretches along that draw where we think we found sediments of the right age, but we won't know until we get radiocarbon dates.
So now Surivel says they've hit a dead end.
Wyoming is a small community and a big social network. I feel like everybody knows everybody at least at arm's length, you know. In particular, if your last name is Eastman or Bishop or Vetter or Hildebrand, and you know about a mammoth that was found south of Douglas in the late 1930s, or if you went to visit the site in 1958 and you have any memories whatsoever about that mammoth, the location it was found, anything at all, it would be useful. In archaeology, a lot of the most important sites aren't found by archaeologists. They're found by local people, ranchers, hunters, hikers, people who are out on the land. Nowadays, it's in vogue, this idea of crowdsourcing scientific problems, but archaeologists have been doing this forever. Many of the most important sites, archaeological sites in Wyoming, weren't found by archaeologists, but were found by members of the public, and by working together, I think we can accomplish a lot more than simply professionals working alone.
That was UW anthropology professor Todd Surivel. We have photos and drone images of the area where they believe the bones must be, if that would help jog your memory. Find them at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. There you can also find Dr. Surivel's contact information. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards. Summer hike up to 13,000 feet can be exhilarating. But what if you decide to stay up there for the rest of your life? The lack of oxygen, frigid temperatures, and sparse vegetation would make it tough. Archaeologists know hunter-gatherers traversed highland areas thousands of years ago, but presumed they also had time in lowland areas in order to survive. After some rare discoveries, that idea is now being challenged. Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson reports.
Archaeologist Randy Haas routinely travels to the Andean Plateau in Peru, and as soon as he arrives, he's immediately reminded why some of his colleagues are reluctant to believe his hypothesis that hunter-gatherers lived here at high altitudes year-round.
I've seen people get off the plane in Juliaca and just fall over, and people will rush out with oxygen tanks because of the lack of oxygen.
Not to mention, it's cold.
If you don't have fancy down jackets and sleeping bags, it's very difficult to keep warm. In other parts of the world where it's cold, you can keep warm by fire. There are not a lot of trees up there, not a lot of fuel to burn at this high elevation.
Haas says the harsh environs means there's not much of something else you need to live.
Your foods, there's not much of that either. So all these things combined seem to make it to be a very challenging place to live.
And that explains why this high elevation region was one of the last frontiers for human settlement.
And for a lot of scholars, it was believed that it wasn't really until you had food production that's what made permanent habitation of these landscapes possible.
We know that between 3,000 and 5,000 years ago, agricultural communities emerged in the alpine valleys of the Andes. The descendants of these early farmers still successfully work the land today. If you've ever eaten quinoa, it was likely grown in this region of Peru.
But not many people had really examined the hunter-gatherers who kind of paved the way.
Haas saw an opportunity to help fill the gap in the historical understanding of how humans came to settle at high elevations.
This one particular site, Soto Macayapata, we knew about from surface remains, scatters of flake stone tools on the surface.
That was a pretty good indicator that evidence of hunter-gatherers might be buried underground at Soro too. But first, he had to meet with the local community to get their blessing to dig right in the middle of their barley field.
What I'd hoped to find at the time were just maybe some house features, hearths. But what I didn't expect to find and what we ended up coming across was a burial assemblage, 16 human individuals.
He knew he'd hit the jackpot, but he was nervous. Nervous how the local community would respond to the disturbance of their ancient ancestors' remains. He says they too were intrigued by the discovery and encouraged him to proceed.
If you want to understand people of the past, one of the best things that you can find are the people themselves. And you can see each one of these bags have different labels on them.
He's handling fragments of 7,000-year-old bones that now sit on his desk in baggies at the University of Wyoming, where he's wrapping up a year-long fellowship. When he first arrived, he shared his find with his colleague at the university, Melissa Murphy, an anthropologist who also studies human evolution in the highlands of Peru. And she immediately knew Haas was going to make an important contribution to the understanding of the occupation of the highlands.
Hunter-gatherers and foragers, they don't bury their dead in cemeteries. There's not going to be large sample sizes.
Murphy studies the Incan Empire, which she admits makes her work a little easier.
It's much sexier if you're going to excavate a pyramid or fancy burials.
But hunter-gatherers were mobile, so they weren't building large structures and accumulating stuff, which means they left behind less clues. So to find a body, let alone 16, is a big deal.
Because there are important transitions that we move from being a hunter-gatherer forager to being a settled pastoralist or a settled agriculturalist. And what happens? How does that come about? And when do humans occupy these higher elevations?
Haas's discovery offered a solid answer to Murphy's questions for several reasons.
If this was a temporary camp monitored from a low elevation base camp, then the old and infirm wouldn't have been coming along. Young children probably would have been left behind. And it turns out that our burial assemblage has two children who are somewhere between ages 4 to 6 years old. We have at least one man who's over 50. We have men and women. And so this was another line of evidence that seemed to suggest that there was a whole population living up here long term.
And the chemical makeup of the bones has a story to tell too. Haas got some help from graduate students who tested the isotopes in the bones. Signature ratios of carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen revealed the altitude where the water and food these folks consumed was sourced.
It was really amazing to see that they fell into the high altitude precipitation values for oxygen, and I was like, these people live there.
Ioana Stefanescu, one of the graduate students, was the first person to see the results.
I remember I put my laptop in my purse and I was like running. I couldn't wait to tell them.
This groundbreaking discovery earned Haas and his team a place in the July issue of Royal Society Open Science, a journal that requires an arduous review of an article before it's published. It's a sign that scholars are coming around to Haas's hypothesis that hunter-gatherers did indeed occupy the highlands full-time, even before the advent of agriculture. Haas's next big question is, how did they do it? He says there's already an important clue. The bodies he found all exhibited evidence of cranial modification, or head shaping. Haas says this physical expression of connection
is telling us something more about the importance of community in not only surviving, but thriving in adverse conditions.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
Evidence of high-altitude living has been found in the Rocky Mountains, too. In 2013, a young Wyoming archaeologist discovered several prehistoric villages in the Wind River Range. At the time, it was one of only three known alpine prehistoric villages. And earlier this year, archaeologists uncovered animal bones and some chipped stones at a site in Golden, Colorado. Preliminary radiocarbon dating results indicated that the soil layer where these items were found was 9,000 years old. Every summer, it takes a village to fight wildfires. There are obviously the firefighters, but there are also people like archaeologists behind the scenes. The Mountain West News Bureau's Maggie Mullen talked to an archaeologist with the U.S. Forest Service who helps decide what needs to be preserved and what can be left to burn.
Outside of fire season, Tara Hamilton's job can sometimes be a bit boring. Paperwork, meetings, but right about now,
It's kind of exhilarating.
Hamilton says she's not necessarily on the front lines.
A lot of the time you can't even see the flames. You're just trying to get out there ahead of the emergency, basically, and figure out what's there and figure out how to protect it if you need to.
And she doesn't always have to leave her desk. When a fire strikes, she says she'll get a call that sounds something like this.
I need to know what cultural resources are in this area because this is where the fire is headed.
Hamilton can use a geographic information system, or GIS, to look at detailed maps of the area and get a better idea of what they're dealing with.
Where are the known sites? What kind of sites are they?
Anything from early indigenous settlements to evidence of pioneers who migrated here on the Oregon Trail.
Are they in danger from fire? Those kinds of sites would be like a cabin, anything with organic components like wood or bone, that sort of thing. We have a lot of historic sites that are combustible.
If she can answer those questions using GIS, Hamilton stays put. But sometimes it's not that easy. The area hasn't been surveyed yet, and no one knows if there are historical artifacts there. When that happens, Hamilton is on the road with a carefully packed bag. Some of the things seem pretty straightforward. Water, surveys, a shovel, GPS. Then it gets a bit more serious. Fire-resistant clothing and very specific footwear.
We have to wear shoes that have the right sole so they won't burn up and melt out there.
And if that doesn't sound scary enough?
One of the things that's absolutely required of everyone on the fire line is a fire shelter. And just in case you get in a bad situation and you can't get out.
Once at the site, bag in hand, she immediately gets to work. She doesn't always know how much time she'll have. It all depends on where and how aggressive the fire is. Hamilton says they look for clues on the surface of the ground. Things like mounds, certain types of vegetation, or a suspicious depression. These could indicate something important underground. Anything from an old military site to a long-gone fur trader post. If she thinks they're standing on a potential site, that area becomes a priority for firefighters.
No prehistoric sites are ever going to be made again. And we certainly don't know everything that we could know about those time periods. Same with, say, turn-of-the-century mining camps or a logging railroad from the 1920s. That stuff's just not going to be made again.
But wildfires aren't always a bad thing for archaeology. Hamilton says sometimes, instead of destroying artifacts, fire reveals them.
There's tons of things out there. People lived all over the place, but you might have, you know, a foot of pine duff and you can't see what's under that until a fire goes through and burns it up.
There's no way to know whether this fire season will bring devastation or discovery for an archaeologist like Hamilton, but she says it will be anything but boring. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
A few years ago, women archaeologists from both Wyoming and Montana started a group called the Sisterhood of the Traveling Trowel. The group tries to help emerging women archaeologists in their careers. Crystal Allegria and Bonnie Smith are both members of the Sisterhood and archaeologists in the Plains Country. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska spoke with both women on the need to help women archaeologists. Kudelska first asked Bonnie Smith what the group's goal was in 2018.
The goal this year was to pay tribute to one of our sisters, one of the founding members of the Sisterhood, Ruth Ann Knutson, who passed away about a month ago. And we are in the process of setting up a scholarship in her name that will go towards young women to help attending conferences, to help with attending field school, you know, just to help.
So the field of archaeology is now almost more dominated by women, but in the past, it was really the opposite. There weren't very many women in this field. And so over the years, with people like Ruth Ann and Alice Kehoe and all these other women, they've really done a good job of making it easier for women to be part of this field. So we, as the sisters, want to honor them and honor their work and their scholarship and their publications and in the way that they've paved for the rest of us to kind of follow behind and make it easier for us to do the work that we love to do.
Why was it important for the Sisterhood of the Trowel to honor Ruth Ann?
It was important because the Sisters of the Traveling Trowel, it was a group that Ruth Ann was a founding member of. So we kind of came up with it a few years ago, and Ruth Ann was there when we came up with that idea. And so for us, it was really important to honor Ruth Ann, not only because of that, because she was a founder of the Sisters of the Traveling Trowel, but also because she was one of those really important sisters who paved the way for other women. And Ruth Ann was tough. I mean, she had a heart of gold. She was a teddy bear underneath, but she was a tough lady, and she would tell it like it was, and she would really push her way through if she needed to. And so to me, she's like the ultimate, you know, sister of the traveling trowel, because she really, she was the way paver in a lot of ways. There's a lot of other women like Ruth Ann too, but for me, she really exemplifies what we are honoring with the Sisters of the Traveling Trowel.
Do you remember a story that she told you guys that's kind of popped out?
So we were talking with Ruth Ann. There was a group of us that were sitting together kind of reminiscing about the women who kind of came before us and who paved the way for us. And so we were talking, and Ruth Ann started talking about Marie Wormington, who was a woman who was an archaeologist at a time when there weren't very many women archaeologists. And
when was that?
It was probably in the kind of the 50s, 60s, the 1950s, 1960s is Marie. 1970s was the time, and Marie Wormington was kind of in that time a little bit later, but that was the time we were kind of reminiscing to, as kind of the women who were doing archaeology in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s is the time frame. And so we were talking about, and she was talking about her, she was close to Marie Wormington, this woman who was a really a foremother in the field of archaeology and plains archaeology. And so she was talking about her and some of the struggles that she had, and how Ruth Ann really looked to her to pave her own career. And Marie really helped Ruth Ann with that, to pave her own career. We were also talking about some of the other women, and so it was a really nice gathering, because we were talking about some of these women who had really paved the way for the current generation. But of course, now the current generation are retired, they're in their mid-70s, and those are the women who paved the way for my generation, who are in their mid to late 40s, and then, you know, now we're helping to pave the way for some of the younger professionals as well. So it was at this, you know, this gathering that we had, there was a few different generations there, so it was really neat to see that, and to see how we kind of mentor each other and help each other move through the field of archaeology. And so archaeology is kind of a different field, because you spend a lot of your time out in the field, and so that's kind of hard for women sometimes, with families and with children, but these women who went before us really figured that out and were able to manage that and do that in a way that was probably very difficult for them, but they figured it out.
And for someone who's not an archaeologist, what is a trowel?
A trowel has many uses. It is usually what we use to remove dirt when we're working excavating a site, centimeter by centimeter, little bit by little bit, and that's what a trowel is. You can also like mortar a wall with a trowel. There's all sorts of uses for a trowel, but it is the primary tool of an archaeologist.
That was Bonnie Smith and Crystal Allegria speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska. We'll be back with part two of this audio archaeological dig on June 19th. David Graff produced this episode. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell, and I'm Melody Edwards. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.